Welcome, friends. Thank you, as always, to John Lee Hooker and Carlos Santana for reminding us so beautifully that change is coming. This is Economic Update, and my name is Richard Wolff. Economic Update is a weekly program about what's happening in the economic parts of our lives. Our goal is to cover the most recent important events, but also to pick one key economic issue each week. The purpose of Economic Update now is to examine an economy in trouble and undergoing change. For economic change to really benefit the majority of people, we have to know more than what is happening. We need to know why and how our economy could and should change in ways that would better serve our needs. Economic Update is a program that aims to do all that. I am your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I teach in the graduate program for international affairs of the New School University in New York City. You can follow my economic analyses at www.rdwolf.com. That's with two F's. I also want to thank Truthout, whose remarkable website is a courageous source of independent news and commentary daily. Check them out at truthout.org. We are interested in your questions and comments. Each week we select one or more and respond on our program. You can email your questions and comments to me via the website again, www.rdwolf.com. Let us know if you would like us to identify you by name and town if we select your question or comment. Please become a fan of the show on Facebook and like our Economic Update page. By following us, you will receive updates about the show and posts of relevant articles and information. You can post questions for me to answer on air there, and I will answer some there and some here on the air as well. Indeed, today I'm going to depart a little bit from our normal plan, and after the introductory economic updates, the way I do start each program, we're going to shift, and instead of a guest and instead of focusing on two major issues, I'm going to try to dig into the backlog of questions and comments so many of you have sent in and do a whole group of them in the assumption that what interests those of you who write to me will also interest many of the rest of you. Okay, let's begin then with economic updates of things in the news that deserve some analysis and some comment. Late last month in April, the mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, chose to veto a bill that was passed by the city council in New York City. The bill in question would have raised the minimum wage to $11.50 an hour. Or it would have allowed companies that provided workers with benefits to pay them as little as $10 an hour with benefits. This was hailed as a wonderful bill by its supporters, because it would boost the fortunes of the poorest New Yorkers. A full year's salary at the minimum wage today is less than $16,000 a year. The poverty level for a family of four, two adults and two children, is over $24,000. So you can get an idea that we're talking here about helping people at the very bottom. I want to throw into relief the image here. A member of the 1%, a personal billionaire, Michael Bloomberg, chooses to veto a bill that would bring working people up from the minimum wage they now live with to $10 an hour plus benefits, or $11.50 without benefits. But most important, beside the sheer stunning confirmation here of the relationship between the 1% and the 99%, what I really want to talk about is what Mayor Bloomberg said in explaining why he was doing this. He said he opposed the raising of the minimum wage because it would be, and now I'm going to quote, a throwback to the era when government viewed the private sector as a cash cow to be milked, end of quote. Let's see now. Let's look at that. The mayor believes that he lives in a world of the United States of America in which we have an era just over that he thinks involved government milking the private sector. When you hear that, you wonder whether the 1% aren't just richer than the rest of us, but live on a different planet. Over the last 5 years, we have all watched as the government poured trillions of dollars of public money into the coffers of private capitalist enterprises. All of our biggest banks, the largest insurance company in the world, AIG, the largest automobile company in the country, General Motors. Where was the money coming from? The government. And who was it going to? Private capitalist sectors. So it isn't that we are worried about the private sector being milked by the government. The reality, Mayor Bloomberg, is exactly the opposite. The public is being milked like a cow on a scale of trillions of dollars when no one would estimate the cost to the private employers in this state of raising the minimum wage being even as little as $1 billion. As one council member said afterwards, after the veto by the mayor, it's interesting. This city now subsidizes private companies in New York City to the tune of $250 million per year. Once again, notice which way the money is going, from the city to the private. But they don't want to make sure that the employees of businesses getting those subsidies get at least $11.50 an hour for their work. The second update has to do with some interesting research done by Professor Gerald Friedman, a professor of economics at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst. And his research was reported in the March-April 2012 issue of Dollars and Cents magazine, a very good source for on-the-money current economic analysis. And I learned some things I thought I would share with you. First, how the outlays of us as Americans on healthcare has changed over the years. And the best way to measure that is to measure the total amount of healthcare spending on doctors, hospitals, drugs and medicines and medical equipment, and finally on medical insurance, the four big parts of our healthcare industry. Back in 1960, a half century ago, Americans spent 5% of their income, total income of the country, on health. In 2010, literally a half century, 50 years later, the percentage of our incomes that we spend on healthcare has risen to just shy of 18%. That's an extraordinary rise. You'd have to look far and wide for any other industry that has been able to capture so much more of our money. What is going on? Well, doctors, hospitals, drug companies, and medical insurers have been doing very well indeed. Very well indeed. Do we have, therefore, the best medical outcomes? Do we live longer than countries that spend much less on health care? And the answer is an unambiguous no. Do we have better mortality rates? You know, do our young people that get born, do they live to a decent life more than in other countries? No. On and on, when you look at the medical outcomes in the United States, we are, to be blunt, not getting what we pay for. Or, if you like, wildly overpaying for the mediocre medical care and health results that we get. Professor Friedman goes on in his article to talk about what might be done and comes up with something called a single-payer system. It's an economic health care insurance program, rather like what exists in Canada today. And he does the calculations, and I thought you'd be interested to see. We could have a single-payer health plan that would cover, and here's a crucial part of it, provide medical insurance, basic health insurance, to every single American citizen, no matter what their age, where they work, whether they're employed or unemployed, everybody would be covered. The right to medical care covered by insurance would be the same as the right to go to a public park and drink water from a public water fountain. How would it work? Professor Friedman asks himself. And he set himself the task of figuring out how could it work in such a way that the majority of Americans would not only get health care as a basic right, but it would cost them less than they're paying now. And he came up with a way. And his way, which you can read about in detail again in Dollars and Cents magazine, March, April 2012, where the footnotes will also take you to the lengthier reports that Professor Friedman has produced. Here's how it works. He devises a system that would provide a single-payer universal health insurance program that would actually leave most Americans with more money in their pocket as well as a better health care system. Indeed, he shows that for the 95% majority in the United States, his plan would leave them with more disposable income. That's more money left in your pocket after you pay your taxes and your share of the health insurance that would have to be paid by everybody. So the 95% of the people would be better off after taxes and after paying for medical care than they are now. The top 5% would pay the tax, and their disposable income, what they have left after paying their taxes and after paying their health care insurance, would be about 10% left for those who are in the 95 to 99%. And the richest 1%, their disposable income would drop by about 15%. So the top 5% would take minor hits to their income, and they're already earning huge incomes, as we know. And the other 95% would be better off in two ways. They'd have more income left than they do now after paying taxes and medical care. And they'd have a much fairer and is a universal health care system. A society that wanted to deal with the problem of health, that wanted to face what it means that over 50 million Americans now have no health insurance at all, would be talking about such a single health care plan, weighing its costs and benefits, and having the kind of national debate that deals with this question, which we've not had so far. The third update for today gives me a chance to talk about the major insurance companies of the United States. And in particular, I'm going to talk about MetLife Insurance Company, a very important one, the Prudential Life Insurance Company, and the John Hancock Life Insurance Company, which is now a unit of Manulife Financial. They recently settled, all three of these companies, they recently settled accusations from the government of doing something which I thought you would all be interested in, since there's a long history of the insurance business behaving in such ways. Here's what happened. Over the last century, tens of thousands of Americans purchased small insurance policies on the lives of their husbands, wives, parents, children, the usual. They were small denominations of $1,000, $5,000, $10,000, money that might have been important back then, but is obviously worth much less now. And it turns out that many of these people, named as beneficiaries who would get the money when they died, people who have forgotten that there was such a policy, lost it, never knew that the policy had ever been created because their relatives forgot to tell them. There are tens of thousands of those. So the question arises, when John or Mary dies, who purchased and fully paid for such a policy 10, 20, 30 years ago, longer, what happens? Do the insurance companies go and beat the bushes to find the people named in these policies so that they can give them the money that has been paid into that policy and which those beneficiaries deserve? And the answer is no. In many cases, these insurance companies did nothing of the sort. So, for example, at the end of April, MetLife agreed to pay several states, including California, Illinois, Florida, and Pennsylvania, a total of $40 million in a negotiated settlement. And a spokesman for MetLife, John Calagna, said the company also expected to release to beneficiaries around the country another $188 million this year, and that over the next 17 years, seems to take them a long time, it might distribute as much as $438 million. We're talking big bucks, really big bucks. Indeed, when you add the same problem, the same settlements being made by Prudential and John Hancock, we're talking money that state officials estimate might go over $1 billion. New York State has been independently pursuing this and has even more money that it has squeezed out of them. What we have here is the following. An insurance company doesn't take the time or trouble to go find the beneficiaries, which they're supposed to do. They keep the money. They use the money to earn more money by making investments with it, and they keep those as their own profits. That's what got the state investigators so angry. And what was the defense of the company? A lot of these people, they said, took out these policies before there was Social Security, which was only begun in the 1930s. Oh, and you couldn't look up in the Social Security system to find their numbers later, the numbers they took later. Strange. And interestingly, the insurance companies assumed people only died after 99 years of age. Under the new settlement, the assumption is 90. They wanted the extra 9 years to not have to look, to assume they weren't dead yet. By the way, the same companies that couldn't find the folks to whom they owed money watch like hawks for all those people whose insurance policy gives them an annuity, a monthly payment, to make sure that the insurance company knows the moment they're dead, because then they no longer have to make payments to them. Turns out the insurance companies are interested when you die because they don't want to pay you money. They're just not interested in when you die, when you deserve money from them. Okay, so much for the updates. A footnote on the insurance issue. Every one of the states in the United States has an insurance commission. Before you can go into the insurance business, you have to satisfy the commission that you're doing it properly, and the commission has all kinds of oversight and rules governing what you do with your assets, how you charge premiums, and so on. Why is this industry, unlike most others, subjected to government regulation in the 50 states? Well, I've just given you an example of why. The insurance industry has a long history of doing things that have led the masses of the American people to demand government oversight. And here we see yet another example of why that oversight is, if anything, insufficient. Today we're going to depart, now that we're done with our typical opening economic updates, we're going to depart a little bit and spend some time on your questions and your comments. You've asked me to respond, and rather than selecting one or two and disappointing so many of you each week because of the limits of our time, I thought I'd devote the rest of time today, to asking questions, to answering questions, to responding to what you have sent in as is important to you. So let me begin, and by the way, when you've allowed me to use your name, I will give it, and when you have asked me not to, I will withhold it. That is your call in every case, past, present, and future. Here's the first, and I'm going to read directly from it. In a truly fair system, colleges and universities, like churches, mosques, and synagogues, would be paying their fair share of property taxes to the communities where they are based. Would you comment on this? And would you comment on whether and how the system should be abolished? Well, let me begin by making sure we're all on the same page on this important question. Institutions that are engaged in charity or in religious work or in education are exempted from paying taxes to the federal government, are usually exempted from paying taxes to their state government, and are usually exempted as well from paying taxes to the local community. This question seems to be focused on the last, the property tax. Since the federal and state governments do not, in general, in the United States, tax property, we're talking about localities, cities, towns, sometimes counties, which do tax property. So in most of America's cities and towns, if you own a home, if you own a small business, if you own a car, you are required to pay a property tax, a certain percentage of the value of your property every year to the city or town to help it function. What does the city and town do with the money it taxes from people's property? The single most important use of money collected by cities and towns is public education. Here in the United States, public education at the primary and secondary school level is considered an appropriate obligation of the city government, not the state, not the federal, the city. So if the cities are going to be required to run our elementary and middle and high schools, well, then they have to be provided with the money. And the tax base for that, the major one, not the only one, but the major one is the property tax, the local property tax. The second rank of things that local city governments do is to provide fire services and police, local police services. Those are quite expensive. And then there's a whole host of other things that cities and towns do, a certain amount of health care provision. They maintain the local roads, you know, from the town in which you live. So we allow churches, charity organizations, and schools or educational institutions not to pay. What that means is we subsidize them because they get all those services that the city provides. Their children are educated in the public schools. They have a fire department that responds in the event that they have a fire. They can call the police if there's a car accident or they want some protection. They benefit from the clean air. They benefit from the roads that function. But they don't pay for any of that. The rest of us do. The individuals who own homes and cars, the small businesses that have a store or an office or a factory and so on. So we have here an example in which some of us subsidize others of us. Now you could ask the question, as this person does, is this fair? Clearly this questioner, she's convinced that it isn't. And she's particularly convinced in terms of wealthy universities. The example I use, because I got my PhD at Yale and I taught at Yale for a while, is the condition of Yale University in New Haven. So let me briefly show you how it illustrates this questioner's concern. Yale is one of the handful of richest universities in the world. It has been around for the entire history of the United States, pretty much. It is extremely wealthy. It has tens of billions, with a B, of dollars in assets that it holds. It runs many hospitals. It's a very big business, and it's a prestigious university. They count on all the services of the city of New Haven, where they are located. But the drama of the situation can be best shown as follows. New Haven continually ranks among the 10 poorest cities in the United States, where poverty is measured by the proportion of families living below the poverty line as a percentage of the total number of families in the community. By that standard, the standard used by the U.S. Census Department, New Haven is one of the poorest cities in the United States. So in one of the poorest cities is located one of the richest universities. But that rich university refuses to pay any taxes, which is its legal right, on all of its educational property in New Haven, which is about 95% of the property it owns. And that property is considerable. Yale is spread out over 200 billion buildings throughout the city. It's the largest single landowner. It's the largest employer in the city of New Haven, which, by the way, is a sizable city of about 125,000 people. So the poorest city in the United States, or one of the poorest cities, New Haven, Connecticut, finds all of its citizens paying higher taxes than they otherwise would have to on their homes, on the rental of their home that is composed of the part the landlord has to pay in taxes, high taxes, on the building they live in. If they own their own home, they pay the taxes directly. If they shop in a local store, the prices are a bit higher because the storekeeper has to pay high taxes. And what do all these people have to pay such high taxes for? Because they have to pay for the services delivered free to Yale University. The poor of New Haven have to pay more to subsidize Yale, one of the richest universities in the world. No wonder in New Haven politics, their system is called Robin Hood in reverse. You take from the poor and you give to the rich. In Connecticut, there are 169 towns. New Haven has the highest property tax rate of all of them. And for most of the last 50 years, it has ranked in the top three or four. Why are the taxes so high? Because Yale doesn't pay. Everybody else has to pay a higher tax to subsidize Yale. The people of New Haven have repeatedly shown that they find this outrageous. But Yale has enough pull with the politicians at both the local and state level to keep it this way. So the question is, do we want this kind of situation across the United States, whether it be Harvard up in the Boston area or Columbia in the New York area or dozens and dozens of other well-heeled, rich private universities, literally demanding and getting free public services no matter what the burden is on the communities who are basically forced to pay the higher taxes to subsidize them. And you know, the same question applies to churches too. It's interesting in the United States that some of the most loud and outspoken people who demand that the rule of our society should be you pay for whatever it is you get don't think that when it comes to the churches of this country and the synagogues and the mosques who want very much to keep getting free services from the towns in which they live. Free fire department service, free police department service, free public education for their children and the children of their parishes and their synagogues and so on. They don't want to have to pay. And they don't want to face the fact that if these institutions and the people who patronize them don't pay, then the rest of us are paying. In the United States, therefore, rich private universities, schools, churches, synagogues, mosques are subsidized by all of us. We redistribute wealth and income from the average citizen to these institutions, and I think that the person who sent me the comment is absolutely right. It is unfair, it shouldn't be allowed, and at the very least, if we want to continue subsidizing these institutions, then we ought to see that the subsidies only go to those who have no money themselves, who can demonstrate that they need it. We do the same in our welfare system, and yet this is welfare for some of the richest Americans. There are those who send their kids to Harvard and Yale and Princeton and so on. If a means test ought to be applied to someone on welfare, if a means test ought to be applied to people looking for unemployment compensation, why in the world is no means test applied to the subsidization of rich private universities and every one of our religious institutions. We're going to take a short musical break now, and we're going to come back and deal with other of your questions and comments.
In my hand, baby, you got my number anywhere that I stand. Oh, I can't wait till I get you next to me.
Welcome back to Economic Update. I'm Richard Wolff, and today we are spending time responding to and commenting on some of your many very interesting and very provocative comments and questions. I turn next to another one, and I'm going to read it because it's nice and short. Quote, "You were very clear about the capitalist system and about the new system that has to replace it. But how do we begin to get there from here?" Well, this is, you know, in many ways the $64 trillion question. But in a way, the answer, which might disappoint you, is one that shouldn't surprise you coming from someone like me. You may understand that the problem is the system, the capitalist system, and that we need to go to a new one, and you may have a clear idea of what that new one is, but that would put you in a place where most Americans are, or at least not yet, arrived. So I would answer that our job now is to mainly make people aware of two things. And when I say make them aware, I mean in our daily conversation, whether it's at the supermarket or at the swimming pool or over a cup of coffee or in the classroom or at the job, in the millions of ways that Americans have of communicating with one another, even at a time of Game Boys and iPads and all the rest that make us isolated. Here's my point. Most people are still looking for the bad guy. They're angry about what's happening in the United States, particularly in economics, which is what we discuss here in this program. And they know that a lot of people are suffering. They know that a lot of things are happening that are not right, that are not good. But they keep looking for the bad guy. So if you're coming at it from the left, it's the banker, maybe, or the government bureaucrat. And if you're coming from the right, well, it's poor people who shouldn't have taken out loans, or it's liberally minded government officials, or it's immigrants. You know the drill. What neither side wants to kind of face, and it's partly because we haven't done that for so long here in the United States, is that there really is no payoff to looking for the bad guys. If you talk to bankers, they will explain to you that given the way banks are set up, given the way their jobs are set up, their rewards and punishments lead them to behave in a way that they're paid to do. It's the way the system works. Likewise, if you go to the other end and you ask a poor family, why did you take out that loan to buy that home? They will look at you and they will explain, "We all went to work. We saved our money to be able to get a down payment, to enjoy something we were told was the American dream, to become American citizens with our own home and with all the security that goes with that. We put away other things we did without in order to have the money to put the down payment. Weren't we doing what we were asked and supposed to do?" And in a way, they're all teaching us, whether they're the banker or the working class family, the way this system works laid out a plan of action for me that I was an honest and enthusiastic person in terms of pursuing and following the directions, building on the education I got to try to fulfill the expectations I were taught as reasonable. My conclusion, and what I think we have to explain to our fellow citizens, is that when everybody plays according to the rules and plays by the system, or nearly everybody, if things then go wrong, the problem isn't this or that bad guy. The problem is a system. The system that tells each of us to behave in a way which, when you add it all up, is not good for us. Let me conclude this argument by reminding everyone of what Adam Smith, the so-called founder of the capitalist system, or certainly one of them, is famous for having said. It runs something like this. If every person pursues his or her own self-interest, maximizing their income, maximizing their profits, if the same is true of businesses as of individuals, then we will all be led as if by an invisible hand to the greatest good for everybody. Now, frankly, I think what I hope many of you think, that this is a rationalization for everybody to do your own thing, because by some magic, some invisible hand, it'll all work out for the best. I think what we're seeing in the United States today is when everybody pursues his or her self-interest according to the rules of the system, we have an economic crisis of gargantuan proportions, the worst since the Great Depression of the 30s, that this is indeed not a system in which everybody pursuing their self-interest will lead to the greatest good. How do we get from this system to another? The first step is to make it clear that system is the problem. System has to get changed. How many people do you know who think that if we just prosecuted and found guilty and fined or imprisoned the people who did bad, our problems would be solved? I'm afraid the answer is, if you did all that and you locked those people away, the people right behind them, the people who will step into their shoes in the company, in the bank, in the government office, they will all be following the same system, responding to the same pattern of rewards and punishments, and so end up, sooner or later, doing pretty much the same. This is not a problem that can be solved in a criminalization of what's going on. In order to get from where we are to someplace else, as per your comment and question, we have to make sure that we even have a nation that understands that the problem is the system. And after all, for 50 years, it has been taboo in America to talk about our system, even to mention its name. Capitalism as a problem has been thought to be impossible, silly, maybe even disloyal. But you know, we do debate every other system in this country, our education system, our health system, our transportation system, you name it. But we have been afraid for 50 years to debate the capitalist system, our economic system. And it deserves to have the same questions raised that we raise about our transportation system, our education system, our medical system. Is it good? Does it serve our needs? If it's broken, how do we fix it? And if it's a system that is fundamentally not working anymore, what would be a better system to establish in its place? If you don't do that for a system in your society, that system begins to malfunction and break down. You need periodic assessment. You need periodic inspection. And you need periodic debate. We have an economic system that isn't working very well, and partly that's because we haven't understood that it's a system that needs criticism and debate. In a sense, your question is one that forces us to think about it. So I think we get from the system we have to a better system that we've discussed on this program and that many of you have ideas about. But the way to do that is by beginning to establish a common basis for us to have the conversation about how we get there. And that requires first that we understand that our problem is indeed a system and not this or that performer or actor within the system. Moving on. I wanted to deal with a very interesting question that came in that has to do with financialization. I recently had a guest on our program here, Professor Bill Tabb, who told us a great deal about the financialization of the economy, how finance, banking, insurance, and so on have become such a major part of the American economy, and how that's associated both with this economic crisis and with the extreme disparity between rich and poor that we talk about so often, and that has become part of the folklore of America with the notion of the 1% versus the 99%. So let's talk a little bit about financialization happening here in the United States. And I wanted to begin by saying, well, we have a historical example of another country in which something very similar happened. And that country is Britain, Great Britain. In the 19th century, when the British Empire was a dominant feature of the world, where the slogan that came out of England was Britannia rules the waves, a reference to the fact that Britain depended on its enormous empire in India and colonies in Asia and Africa, and that here was this small island offshore of the main part of Europe, and yet it was the global powerhouse, the overwhelmingly dominant empire, and so on. During the 19th century, Britain was a leader in manufacturing, in the textile industry, which helped Britain to become the great empire that it was, in the production of items made out of iron and steel, all kinds of shipping, and so on. But in the 20th century particularly, and already at the end of the 19th, Britain was going through a change. Manufacturing began more and more to happen elsewhere. Even service production moved out of Great Britain. What stayed in Britain was finance. It's called in England the City of London, or sometimes just the City. It's that part of downtown London where the skyscrapers are full of banks, investment banks, commercial banks, insurance companies, export-import firms, and so on, the financial sector. And it became larger and larger in England until now it is the dominant, and has been for a long time, the dominant dynamic sector. England is not known for what it produces in terms of manufacture anymore, and it isn't known for sure in terms of its agricultural output. It is known above all for the financial sector that dominates both London and the British economy generally. So the United States, even though we're a much larger geographic and by population too, we are going in a similar pattern. We are finding that finance is growing, but it is partly growing because the other parts of our economy are growing much, much less slowly or shrinking altogether. And they're certainly shrinking in terms of their relationship if you look at it the following. What portion of American enterprises that used to be involved in producing goods and services are now either made the transition to financial companies. So, for example, as Bill Tabb told us, when General Motors became less a company making cars and more a company making loans to people interested in buying cars, or the company, if it stayed in manufacturing, moved its actual manufacturing out of the United States to another part of the world, leaving Americans to have to scramble to look for jobs in something else. Well, what is this all about? And the question asked of me is this some kind of built-in or even natural process? And the answer is it's neither built-in nor natural. It's a function of the choices that are made, both private enterprise choices and government enterprise choices. And let me show you that by talking a little bit about the problems of a capitalist economic system that help create the financialization we're now witnessing. Capitalism has always had an inside, deep inside itself, a contradiction, a clash between two aspects of the same system that is never resolved. And the best way to explain it is this way. Every capitalist employer, whether he or she runs a hamburger joint or a shirt factory or a beauty salon, it doesn't matter. Large or small, every capitalist is driven by the competition he or she faces from other companies as well as by their own desire to become wealthy, to try to reduce their wage bill. What does this mean? If you can get by with fewer workers, do it. If you can get by paying your workers less, do it. If you can substitute less expensive workers for the ones you now have, do it. Capitalists are better off if they can get the same amount of work from their workers by paying them less, one way or the other. Profits up if wage costs go down. Other things the same. So far, so good. What's the problem here? There is no problem except for this. If capitalists individually are successful in driving down the number of workers they pay or the amount they pay their workers, here's one result. Those workers, either laid off or paid less, will have less money to spend. And who do they spend the money on? The products of capitalist enterprises. So notice, the capitalists push hard to reduce the wage bill they pay. And yet by doing so, they diminish what those workers have, and those workers are the vast majority, in the way of spending. And so those same capitalists discover that their success in reducing their wages comes back to bite them as a problem in not having a market or demand for their goods to sell. They've never resolved this tension. They've never resolved this contradiction. So when they are successful in driving down wages, when they are successful in reducing the number of people they hire, for example, in the United States, after the 1970s, wages, which had been rising for 100 years, stopped rising in the United States. Computers and other technical devices allowed employers to substitute machines for people. And the export of companies opening branches abroad meant that they could fire workers in the United States and hire cheaper ones abroad. They did all of that. They made lots of money in the 80s and 90s doing all of that. They cut their wage bill. But then they discovered that all the profits they made by cutting their wage costs were now facing a working class in the United States that didn't have much money, couldn't buy this stuff, couldn't buy the way they used to. So what happened in the 80s and 90s was a temporary fix. And the temporary fix went like this. The corporations who had knocked down their wage costs by technology, by stopping to pay wage increases, by moving production to cheaper workers in the rest of the world, they began to notice, our working class is not going to buy from us. We're going to be in a jam. But they were saved from that jam becoming intense in the 80s and 90s by two things that the working class did. First, it worked more hours. Workers responded to lower wages by taking any job they could, saying to the employer, okay, you won't pay us so much for a first job. Here's what I'll do. I'll take a second job. I'll work for too little money in both jobs, and I'll get by that way. But the even more impressive thing American workers did was borrow money. And here comes the real clincher. Where did they get the money to borrow from? From the same corporations who had more because they were paying them lower wages, who took the enormous extra profits they got from lowering the wages and lent them back to the workers, which allowed the workers to keep buying. So notice how the system worked. Capitalists got what they want. They cut the wage bill. But they didn't suffer the usual consequence of workers not having enough because they lent the workers the money to buy. That's how buying was maintained in the 80s and 90s in the United States. But how was that all worked out? How did the corporations get their extra profits from cutting wages into the hands of workers as borrowed money on their credit card and their mortgage? The answer was the financial industry. We had to explode the banks, the mortgage brokers, the credit card specialists, the hedge funds. The whole apparatus of finance was necessary to take the extra profits from businesses that had crunched down on their wages and funnel them into the hands of the mass of workers as loans in order to keep up consumption, even though you weren't paying the workers the wages that they would have otherwise needed to buy stuff. But here's the clincher. If that's what financialization does, it is at best a temporary fix. Because if the workers' wages aren't going up, you can't keep lending them the money, because on flat wages, a growing debt will hit a dead end. 2007 and 2008 were the dead end reached by a financial system that could grow tremendously to solve that capitalist contradiction between pressing down wages and finding you got nobody who can buy your output. The loan solved the temporary problem, but only at the cost of bringing a bigger crisis, the one we're in now, as the conclusion. And here's a bonus from the importance of this question. If my analysis is correct, then a quick fix is not in order now. We can't solve this problem by austerity, by a government deficit, by a Dodd-Frank bill. We have to radically reorganize our economy because the financialization that grew up to solve capitalism's contradiction is no longer able to play that role. Let me turn next to the last comment and question we even have time for today to deal with one that I thought was interesting. It comes from Andrew Alderfer from Chicago, who gave me permission to use his name. And here's his quick question. Looking at history, how can we understand the effect that economic conditions have on the ability of a citizenry to be politically active? Really good question. Well, first of all, economic conditions always shape how active people can be. To be honest, a democratic system, a system in which we all participate in the decisions that affect us, would require us to have the time to learn about those decisions that have to be made, to hear the different sides on each question, to teach ourselves what we need to know to make a reasonable decision. Any society that was genuinely committed to having the people democratically participate would have to provide the time each week, paid for by somebody, to allow people to learn, to pursue, to study, to get themselves acquainted with what the issues are, to get answers to their questions from people who can be relied upon to provide reasonable answers, to weigh alternative answers. That takes time, it takes energy, and someone has to be paid to do that because you can't give up your regular job and your regular income to do it on your own, unless you're a lawyer or a doctor or somebody with a lot of money, which is why those people are much more politically active most of the time than the rest of us. So if you want to know the first thing about what's needed for a politically active citizenry, it's a recognition, which, by the way, is quite rare, that people have to be provided with the means and the support to learn and participate in an equal way. You know, many people comment that in Europe, elections are on Sunday. You know why? Because people aren't working on Sunday and they can do it. In the United States, our elections are on Tuesday, and our participation is lower. The last two elections for president that are in France that have occasioned a lot of interest were held on Sundays, and 80% of the French people went to the polls. In the United States, it's on Tuesday. 50% go. Hint, you have to help people, provide the wherewithal. So I think that the first rule of understanding the relationship between economics and political participation is to understand that in most societies, no provision is made economically to enable people to fully participate. Only those who have wealth or leisure time or some special circumstances can do that. That's why politics is in this country, for example, a profession of particular people who specialize in it, because the rest of the people are working too hard under too many stresses in their economic life to participate at all. Final point. Over the last 30 years in the United States, political participation has shrunk from the levels before, which weren't that great to begin with. 30, 40 years ago, people participated in local political clubs in many cities in the United States. Local political machines, whatever you think about them, had large numbers of people involved. Today, involvement is much, much less. A sociology professor at Harvard named Robert Putnam wrote a wonderful book with a strange title, Bowling Alone, in which he documents the withdrawal from political life and social life and community life of Americans over the last 30 years. They withdrew because they were working more jobs, as I mentioned before, because they were worried about the debts they were accumulating, as I mentioned before. And so they economize on social and political and community and civic participation. One of the costs of the economic development of this country over the last 30 years was not only to make 1% very rich and 99% not so, but it was also to withdraw masses of people from real political participation. So now it's a matter of advertising, big bucks, and media blitzes. That's all that we have time for today. I want to thank you all for your listening to this program, Economic Update, for sending me so many interesting questions and comments. Please send them again. And if you would like to have future programs devoted to these kinds of conversations about them, let me know in your comment and we'll do more of it.
For the home of the road, baby, thing gonna change. My time, babe. Thing gonna change.